We are joined once again, live in the studios, by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike.
You've got a big smile on your face.
I do.
Which I guess all will be revealed in the next 58 minutes.
Anyway. Yeah.
So we didn't do it last week, but just a quick update on Jov, because I know people mm-hmm. keep wondering what's
he's
going on.
He's out of the hospital now.
He's been out for a week.
Yeah, been
going
through recovery.
Thought he might be here today, but you know,
well,
takes
you
longer
know.
To recover than one.
Yeah, major surgery. So he's been recovering at home, getting his energy back slowly, and he thinks that he may be here next week. But we will see how it goes. We don't want to push him.
No, and too many variables involved with this. So,
mm-hmm.
But he is writing more online, and so fingers crossed he'll be back here sooner or later.
Yeah,
probably sooner than later. So, meanwhile, apparently the city continues to rotate in the swirly motion as it goes down the tubes.
No. The city council, I mean, it's summertime, so the city council is slowing down a little bit in some of its activities. But it did have a hearing of its land use committee to look at and pass the accessory dwelling units bill out of committee. That bill would allow properties in single family zones to have a main residence plus up to two accessory dwelling units, a backyard cottage and a mother-in-law apartment within the main residence. The backyard cottage is often called the detached accessory dwelling unit, or the DADU technical parlance. The committee considered 11 amendments to the bill. Among the amendments that they approved are backyard cottages of more than two stories can cover up to 60% of the backyard area. Formerly, that was only backyard cottages of one story. As long as no trees over a certain size are cut down, and the size limit is 2 feet in diameter, or 2 feet measured around the circumference of the tree, 4.5 feet above the ground. So that's the so that's the size limit for trees that need to be retained if you're building a backyard cottage. Another of the amendments is an amnesty program for existing ADUs, or accessory dwelling units, that were built without a permit. So the Department of Construction is supposed to come up with a program to allow people who have current ADUs to get them approved by the city, even though they were built without a permit. And then a request for the city to report back to the council about how many ADUs end up being used as short-term rentals, like on Airbnb for tourists, instead of as long-term rentals for city residents. And an amendment to request that the city's Department of Construction include information in its annual report on the demographics of homeowners who seek permits to build ADUs, their tenants, and the amount of rent that they charge for those units. Now, those last two amendments were added because there's some concern that ADUs will be used mainly as short-term rentals, or that big real estate developers will seek to buy older homes and tear them down to build three newer, more expensive homes on each lot, which would lead to more gentrification and rising rents in single-family neighborhoods. To counter the first problem, Councilmember Lisa Herbold had proposed an amendment to prohibit outright the use of ADUs as short-term rentals. But that amendment was voted down by Mike O'Brien and Abel Pacheco. Bruce Harrell, who was also at that committee meeting, only supported it for detached accessory dwelling units, the backyard cottages, not mother-in-law apartments, with the idea that there are many homes that already have internal short-term rentals, internal apartments like mother-in-law units that they use as short-term rentals, as you know, a form of supplementing their income, and that he didn't want to penalize those folks. Now, Pacheco said that many residents of his district rent apartments to students, and they should have the freedom to rent those spaces to tourists in the summer when they would otherwise sit empty. O'Brien suggested that the council could revise the law again at a later date if needed, and that he just didn't think he had enough information to approve the amendment, which is where those the amendments that did get approved request for demographics on who files for a permit to build an ADU and who they end up renting it to come into the picture. Now, another amendment proposed by Herbal would have required a landowner to own a single-family residence for at least 1 year before they could apply for a permit to build a second ADU. There would be one exception if that second ADU is a rent-restricted unit. Ostensibly, this would favor homeowners and be a burden to developers who would want to design and build both ADUs at the same time. Typically, when a developer comes in, knocks down an older residence and wants to build something new, if they're going to build three detached, if they're going to build two units, a main unit and a detached unit, and a mother-in-law apartment, they're going to want to do it all at once just to save money rather than build the first residence with the mother-in-law apartment, then wait a year and build the second unit in the backyard. She was thinking, okay, this would definitely favor homeowners who are thinking of maybe putting another dwelling unit in their backyard. Now, again, that amendment was voted down by O'Brien and Pacheco. Harold did vote with Herbold for that amendment, so Herbold withdrew it. The legislation already contains no requirement that the property owner live on site. So the second amendment, I think, would have been a really good way to address the gentrification concern, and it may end up being brought back when the full council votes on this issue, votes on the whole bill. Now, the bill did pass out of committee without the two amendments that Herbold had proposed, and it's going to come up for a vote on July 1st. Monday, July 1st, this next Monday. Now, Abel Pacheco, I think, is proving himself to be much more sympathetic to developers than he first seemed.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like he pretty much would have voted the exact way Rob Johnson would have voted.
Yeah, He's been pretty much continuity there in terms of his job as replacing Rob Johnson on the council. And Mike O'Brien appears to just want to kind of to just get this bill passed after working on it for at least four long years. And if you think about it, it's really going to be a big part of his legacy, having passed the MHA and passing this ADU bill. But again, it's going to be up to the new city council, the one that's elected in November, to keep an eye on the impact of both the MHA and this new ADU bill, and make necessary changes if they feel that it's actually leading to more gentrification and displacement in Seattle's neighborhoods.
Well, anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. It sounds like some of the parties interested in this new city council weighed in this week with some of their picks for who they'd like to see win the race.
Yeah, various organizations are beginning to announce their endorsements in each of the city council districts. You know, labor groups, the District Democrats, environmental groups, and the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, PAC, the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy, this week announced their list and gave their seal of approval for a selection of candidates from the different district races. And I'm just going to go over those candidates pretty quickly here. District 1, they endorsed Phil Tavel, not Lisa Herbold, the incumbent running in that district, but Phil Tavel, a lawyer and former school teacher and video game developer. His campaign has been largely self-financed, although some of his biggest contributors are real estate developers. But there's more when you dig into his contributors. One contributor, Michelle Ebert, is the owner and manager of Kitten's Cabaret Strip Club and the Doghouse Bar and Grill, which are in District 2, not in his district. Her ex-husband, Dave Ebert, was a strip club manager who was prosecuted in 2010 for running a prostitution ring in four Seattle strip clubs that were owned by Frank Colacurcio Sr. And Ebert was a known longtime associate of Frank Colacurcio. Now, another donor, Anthony Goslin, works at the Sands Showgirls, another strip club, which is in Ballard. And that's in District 6, not in District 1. And Denny Barron works at Lacey O'Malley Bail Bonds in downtown Seattle, which is in District 7. So, you know, these businesses are not in his district. So you might ask, why are these people donating to his campaign? I think it's because these folks, it's because he knows these folks through his day job as a criminal defense attorney. And it shows you the type of clients that he's taken on in his work as a criminal defense attorney. And of course, also, I don't want to say, you know, it would be bad to ever elect a criminal defense attorney. And I know that criminal defense attorneys defend people who do sometimes terrible things or accused of doing terrible things and who are not always guilty of those things. But when someone has these kinds of connections, you may want to think again about electing them to sit on the city council. I know that Heidi Wills and Judy Nicastro were both lost their reelection campaigns primarily because people were concerned about their connections to Frank Colacruccio and real estate developers. But you were seeing some of these same connections here with Phil Tavel.
What was labeled Strippergate back then.
Yeah, exactly. And then in District 2, Case endorsed Mark Solomon, the crime prevention coordinator at the Seattle Police Department, who formerly worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C., then as an intelligence analyst at McCord Air Force Base. He also ran his own private security consulting firm, Obsidian Security Group. He's also taken contributions from a lot of real estate developers and real estate brokers, and also from the Washington State Democrats, the State House Rep Gail Tarleton, and folks who work at City Hall. So he's very much part of the sort of mainstream pro-business Democrats, particularly the ones who are concerned about public safety issues.
Gail Tarleton used to work for SAIC, which was a
defense contractor. Yeah, District 3, the endorsement there, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce endorsement there is Egan O'Ryan, the director of the Capitol Hill Chamber of Commerce and a gay pride activist. He is definitely the most business-friendly face in the District 3 race. He has the support of former Deputy Mayor Tim Sice and his business partner Ryan Bain, who lobbies on behalf of Amazon, Vulcan, AT&T, and others. O'Ryan's biggest contributors include a who's who of corporate Seattleites, including former Safeco CEO Paula Rossput Reynolds, who sits on the boards of several Fortune 500 companies, developer Howard Wright, Judith Runstad, Gregory Moga of Moga Investments, and Paul Sutzman, owner and founder of Office Lease. And O'Ryan has received donations from lots and lots and lots and lots of Amazon employees. And he is also the one candidate in the race who routinely tries to demonize Shama Sawant and particularly hammers her on her enmity against Amazon. Now, District 4, the case endorsee there is Alex Peterson. Should come as no surprise. He was the legislative aide to former city council member Tim Burgess, and he was formerly employed by Bank of America, Alliant Asset Management, and the real estate huge global real estate services company CBRE. His job there was to make sure that the bank's affordable housing investments could be profitable for the bank's clients. Predictably, his biggest donors include real estate brokers and property owners in his district, Amazon and Microsoft employees, and his own wallet to the tune of $18,609 that he's contributed to his own campaign.
And yet people have stated that one of his platforms is he will not accept corporate contributions.
Yeah, which is interesting. Now, District 5, the case endorsee there is Deborah Juarez, and that should come as no surprise either. She's the only incumbent that the chamber is backing this year. In addition to voting to repeal the employee hours tax, Juarez's sole job on the council has been to wrangle funding for the new waterfront park and the renovation of Key Arena for a National Hockey League team. In addition, she's bragged about the new practice ice arena that's going to be built in the Northgate Mall area, ostensibly on a site that was originally meant for more housing. Notably, only 17% of her campaign contributions have come from residents of her own district. More than double that amount, or 36%, has come from donors who live outside of the city of Seattle, who you would think would have no skin in the game. But developers, yeah, they do. Now, District 6 the chamber gave a dual endorsement to Heidi Wills and Jay Fothy, and I will talk about them in just a few minutes here. And then next week, I will talk about the District 7 candidates. The Seattle Chamber of Commerce endorsed two candidates in that race, Michael George and Jim Pugel. Just, I'll talk about them more next week, but just quickly, Michael George is the one that has the most real estate developer backing among his donors, and Jim Pugel is a former interim Seattle police chief.
All right.
And, you know, so all of these candidates are candidates who endorsed, who filled out the case questionnaire, so they actively sought the endorsement. Case did not endorse anybody who did not fill out their questionnaire or actively seek their endorsement. Some candidates chose in each of the city council districts chose not to fill out the questionnaire or seek the endorsement because they didn't want to be perceived as in the pockets of big business. So it's no surprise that Case didn't endorse Shama Sawant, for example, or Sean Scott in District 4. I doubt they sought that endorsement. Case has not released a list of who did and didn't seek their endorsement, so we don't know for sure. You can ask the individual candidates.
Have we seen a copy of the questionnaire yet either?
I have seen a copy of the questionnaire, and it is predictably, I mean, they at the beginning of the questionnaire, it asks the typical questions that people have, concerns that people have about transportation, affordable housing, et cetera. And then the last few questions are all about how much do you support businesses in the city of Seattle, and will you always consult with the business community before you make any major decisions? Those kinds of questions that, you know, very much a pro-corporate and pro-business candidate would say yes to. And any other candidate who wants to represent everyone in their district would say, wait a minute, at the very least.
Okay. And by business community, we mean the large businesses.
The large business.
Not the mom and pops.
The Seattle Chamber of Commerce makes a big deal about how, and Case makes a big deal about how, you know, we represent a lot of small businesses too, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I have to say that I know plenty of small businesses that don't donate to the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, and just
and don't belong to it.
I mean, it's important on definitions because small businesses, if I remember correctly, are like at are rated at 200 up to 200 or several hundred employees by the very definition.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, I used to work at a small business that was quite large, had multiple large buildings around town, but it was labeled as a small business based on the definition.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, the definition isn't always how many employees you have. Sometimes it's defined
it's
as
money,
as what were your gross profits,
right.
You know, and it goes way up into the millions before you're considered even a medium size business in the tens of millions. So now I also want to say too that Case has not made any campaign contributions yet. They've collected close to $900,000, and I expect they'll hit the $1 million mark pretty soon and exceed that fairly easily. A Case spokesman indicated this week that they would be waiting until closer to the primary before making contributions to their chosen candidates, possibly waiting until the week that ballots are mailed out to voters. The primary is Tuesday, August 6th, and state law requires that ballots be mailed out no later than 18 days before an election. And that deadline would be Friday, the 19th of July. So that's less than a month away. So there isn't a whole lot of time between now and then for the other candidates who were not endorsed by Case to collect as much money as they can to offset the enormous amount of donations that Case will be able to make to push their favored candidates. Now, interestingly, like you said, there are some candidates that they've endorsed who've said that they're not going to take corporate sponsorship. Or, for example, Jim Pugel has said that he's not going to accept money from PACs. So it'll be interesting to see if when Case makes the offer of money, if those candidates change their mind or if they decide to refuse that money.
But can't, in addition to PACs making specific donations, can't they also just buy advertising as they see fit?
Yeah, they can, and not necessarily work with the campaigns themselves. They can buy advertising independently from those campaigns that touch on issues.
So they can still support these candidates even if the candidates don't want them to support them.
Yeah, even if the candidates don't accept the help directly. Yeah. Let's just put it that way, because generally, if the candidate doesn't want them to do it, there are ways they can make them stop or they can tell them to stop, or make it very public that they want them to stop. But for the most part, that's not how it works. It's usually you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back, and the candidates kind of look in another direction while the PACs do what they
little hand yeah. moves into the pocket and grab something.
Yeah. Anyway, right. So let's talk a little bit about the District 6 City Council candidates. District 6 is Seattle neighborhoods just north of the Ship Canal, from Ballard in the west to Green Lake on the east, with Fremont and Finney Ridge in between, and a portion of Greenwood as well. This was Mike O'Brien's district, and he chose not to run for re-election this year. So the candidate that has collected the most money is Heidi Wills. And when you Google Heidi Wills, the first thing that comes up is a Seattle Times article that announces her candidacy. That article is entitled, quote, "After Strippergate Ethics Scandal, Heidi Wills Wants Back on the City Council," end quote. And that pretty much says it all. Wills was a one-term council member from 1999 to 2003, who got into hot water for accepting donations from associates of the strip club king Frank Colacurcio. Hello, Phil Tavel. She later met in secret with representatives of his company and then voted for a Lake City zoning change that favored his businesses. Wills ended up paying a $1,500 fine related to an ethics violation over this vote, and she lost her reelection campaign. And she is known for that four-year term on the city council as a city council member who did not do very much while she was in office. Now, you might ask, what has Wills been doing in the 16 years since she was last working as a politician in Seattle? She's been running a golfing charity for kids and volunteering at her kids' schools. She calls herself a strong environmentalist, but she's mostly worked with mainstream green groups like the Sierra Club, Climate Solutions, and Conservation Northwest. In fact, I think she sits on the board of the local Sierra Club, or is a director of the local Sierra Club. Now, Wills was a supporter of Jenny Durkin's run for mayor and will likely support her policies on city council. She says she's for more affordable housing, more transportation choices, infrastructure improvements, public safety, and, quote, keeping our parks clean because this is the role of local government, end quote. In other words, she supports the encampment sweeps, essentially. In fact, she would like to double the number of people on the navigation team. She is against the employee hours tax, but hasn't made any suggestions of her own on how to raise additional revenue in the city government. She's for increasing density in Seattle, but doesn't give any specifics of what she would or wouldn't support, saying only that single-family neighborhoods are part of what makes Seattle great. That's about as detailed as she gets. She has raised $74,960, so almost $75,000, with 43% of that in democracy vouchers and a $350 contribution from her own pocket. Unlike the other candidates in the race who have about half of their contributions from District 5, Wills has only 34% of her contributions from people within her own district. A whopping 21% are from outside Seattle, and that is higher than just about any other candidate I've seen, except maybe Deborah Juarez. Now, Jay Fathy is the candidate who is right behind her in the fundraising. He's a family physician who has worked at the 45th Street Community Clinic at Swedish Medical Center and the UW School of Medicine, serving low-income folks and also teaching grad students. He's also the president and CEO of Coordinated Care, which serves Medicaid beneficiaries in Washington State through our state's healthcare exchange. He seems to understand the root causes of homelessness, but he falls into the trap of assuming that Seattle is undergoing a crime wave related to its homeless population. On his website, Step 4 of How to Deal with Homelessness says, quote, "Our attention must be focused on violent and repeat offenders." And that's and he emphasizes that on his website. And it stands out from all the other text on what he would do about homelessness. So clearly he equates homeless people with violent and repeat offenders, in other words, criminals. As for increasing density, he's not much better than Heidi Wills. He has a very vague statement that, yes, we need more housing, but of course gives no specifics on what he'd support in order to get more housing. As for transportation, he's for more transit and sidewalks, safer streets, completing the bike lane network, and making transportation more accessible for disabled folks. but we should, quote, ensure new plans don't mistakenly penalize individuals who need to use cars to travel, end quote. So he's really a very conservative, pro-business mainstream Democrat, just falls well within what the parameters of what the Seattle Chamber of Commerce would like. He has a lot of endorsements, including former council member Tim Burgess, former state representative Ruth Kagey and Brady Walkinshaw, and SEIU 775, that's the Home Healthcare and Nursing Home Workers Union. Both Jay Fathi and Heidi Wells have been endorsed by Case. I just want to emphasize that. He has raised $72,700, 60% of which is in democracy vouchers with a $350 contribution of his own money. About 49% of his contributions come from District 6, and that's pretty standard for most of the other candidates in the race. And 14% are from outside Seattle. Now, the third candidate, the third best at fundraising, is Dan Strauss. He's a senior policy advisor to Councilmember Sally Bagshaw, and before that, he was legislative aide in Olympia to Senator Dave Frocht. On homelessness, he supports getting people into shelters and building permanent supportive housing. He thinks we should treat homelessness not as a countywide problem, but as a regional tri-county problem. King, Pearson, Snohomish. As for housing affordability, he supports zoning for duplexes and triplexes, but, quote, will work hard to ensure that current residents are not pushed out of the district, end quote. I assume he means pushed out by upzoning single-family lots. On transportation, he wants to bring light rail to Ballard faster than Sound Transit plans call for, and I'm not sure how he would do that. And I don't think he's quite sure because he doesn't give any details on how he would do that. He wants to build more dedicated bus lanes and have bus service every 10 minutes. And he supports finishing the bike lane network. But he doesn't say how he would pay for all of that. And he doesn't list any tax policies or budget issues or fiscal issues or fiscal policies at all on his platform that's on his website. And of course, all the things he's listed you're going to need more money for. Now, he's endorsed by his boss, Sally Bagshaw, by former state rep Justin Farrell and the King County Young Democrats, and a separate SEIU branch, 1199NW, that's Nurses, Pharmacists, and Other Healthcare Workers Union. He has raised $58,374 with 65% of that in democracy vouchers, a pretty good sign, and a tiny $10 contribution of his own money. About 49% of his contributions are from District 6, which is pretty standard for the folks in this district, and 12% from outside Seattle. So not a bad candidate, but I'm not quite sure if he wouldn't be one of those candidates more easily swayed to the pro-business side. And not a whole lot of details about what he would actually do if he were elected to the council. Now, candidate number four is Sergio Garcia, the Seattle police officer who moved to Seattle for its, quote, charm, cultural diversity, progressive values, and proximity to nature, end quote. And he's the guy with the mustache. Not the guy with the mustache, but the guy with the mustache. And if you've ever looked at photos of the candidates, you'll know what I mean. Now, on the region's drug addiction problem, he supports diversion programs and increased funding for mental health and addiction treatment. He's a supporter of regional coordination of homeless services. He also thinks the city should listen to what homeless people have to say about the services available and why they're not using them, which is a good point. At the same time, though, he says the city has to identify the criminal element among the homeless population and deal with it. As for police reform, he says he's for a community policing model that gets officers out of their patrol cars and walking the beat. He would focus on hiring locals to serve in the Seattle Police Department and encourage them to live in the communities where they work. He's actually one of the only candidates in this year's council races that I've seen yet to even mention the police reform issue. And his website contains detailed policy proposals on police reform and a redesign of the entire North Precinct, which is actually a very interesting document to read. And I would recommend people read it, whether or not you decide to support Garcia or not. Now, on other issues, his website was very vague about things like housing affordability. But in essence, he's saying he's for more housing, but not changing the character of single-family neighborhoods, kind of like the other candidates in the race so far. He does support ADUs, but is against large developments and says, quote, maybe it's time for us to get out of the way and let property owners help in this battle to increase housing supply, end quote, which you could take to mean a lot of different things. So you could take it to mean support for real estate developers, or you could take it to mean support for small individual property homeowners. It's just not very clear there. And on other issues, he also doesn't have a whole lot of details. He's endorsed by the Teamsters Local 117 and a list of businesses and organizations within the district, including the Ballard Annex, Sunset Tavern, Hattie's Hat, and Roots Young Adult Shelter. He has raised $42,139, with 80% of that in democracy vouchers, and a $2,096 contribution of his own money. 63% of his contributions are from District 6, so he's the outlier there, having many more contributions from his own district than the other candidates. And he only has 2% of his contributions from outside Seattle. And 88% of his contributions are under $200. So a lot of democracy vouchers, a lot of little contributions, and a lot of people from his own district. So he actually could garner more votes than we think. Mm. Now, just there are two more candidates who have raised significant amounts of money in this very crowded field. There are a total of 13 candidates in the District 6. So this was a lot of work to wade through all of them. And I just want to cover those. Did you have a question, Mike?
No.
Okay. I just want to cover
what you got.
The other two, yeah. Number five on the list is John Lisbon. He's president of Seattle Fair Growth, a community group that's part of the Seattle Coalition for Affordability, Livability, and Equality, and Equity, excuse me. Their acronym is SCALE. SCALE consists of 29 neighborhood groups that form to oppose the mandatory housing affordability upzones passed by the city council on the basis that they would displace low-income residents, small businesses, and lead to gentrification in their neighborhoods. There were probably also some folks among those groups who didn't like the idea of upzoning single-family residences as well, although they have chose not to take the extreme route of supporting Speak Out Seattle or Save Seattle. Now, he seems to understand the root causes of homelessness, Lisbon, and is knowledgeable about what the city is currently doing and not doing to address it. He's one of the few candidates I've seen so far who understands the details of what the city is actually doing in terms of homelessness services and services, human services in total. He would increase all types of shelters, including emergency shelters, tiny house villages, FEMA tent cities like Tacoma has, and building more 24/7 shelters with wraparound services. He adheres to the housing first model of low barrier shelters. In other words, you get people into housing first and then you meet them where they're at in terms of providing services that help them transition to from having an addiction, for example, to being drug free or at least having their addiction under control and being in a place where they can live in a home permanently. So he's very much sort of understands what needs to be done in order to transition people off the street. Now, he thinks regional coordination is important, especially for providing the necessary mental health services and drug and alcohol treatment, but also, and get this, also for expanding the funding base for homelessness services. And I think that's a really important distinction because most people who say, oh, we should be doing a regional coordination, oh, we should be coordinating with the county, they don't really tell you why they think that's important. He was very clear that we need more money and the way to expand the funding base is you expand to a regional system. And I think that's important to understand that he's thinking about it. Now, he also supports preventive services to keep people in their homes, including rental vouchers, job training, domestic violence support, and improving coordination among human services providers. And that's also very good policy as well. On affordable housing, Lisbon calls for more planned growth, levying impact fees on developers to pay for public infrastructure, schools, roads, parks, etc., and investing in tiny homes, allowing ADUs, encouraging more transit-oriented housing, and using a portion of the real estate excise tax to revive the city's growth-related housing fund. That fund would pay for the development of low-income housing. He supports Lisa Herbold's proposal to require one-for-one replacement of low-income housing in neighborhoods at high risk for displacement. Now, to deal with traffic congestion, Lisbon supports levying a per-mile driving tax and congestion zone pricing, which is a controversial issue right now in the city. He also supports building out the bike lane network and making transit improvements. Unlike the other candidates in this district, he does have a tax reform policy, a fiscal policy, which includes lobbying for a state income tax and removing the state B&O tax altogether. He pledges to follow four priorities in considering new taxes or fees. Equity, is it a progressive tax? Financial feasibility, will the tax adapt with a changing economy? Political judicial feasibility, will the tax pass constitutional and political muster? And administrative feasibility, how easy is it to implement and enforce that tax or fee? Now, under these four criteria, he probably wouldn't have supported either the employee hours tax because of its lack of political feasibility, or the high net income tax the city council passed in 2017 and which is currently tied up in the courts because of its lack of judicial feasibility. So it's worth keeping that in mind. But he does at least have a plan, which is more than any of the other candidates in this district race. Now, of all the candidates in the race, he's probably, I would think, the most progressive. He has raised $36,197 with 58% of that in democracy vouchers, also well above some of the other candidates, and $6,841 of his own money. About 53% of his contributions are from District 6, so about within that same 50% range that other candidates in the race have. So one final candidate has raised significant amounts of money. That's Terry Rice. Now, he looks like, I wrote this down, I'm actually going to say it. Okay. He looks like he's still in high school. But actually, he's worked for the tech startup company Porch.com, which is an app for housing renovation services. And his current gig is managing director of Savor Seattle, which gives food tours of Seattle area restaurants for tourists. He's based in the Pike Place Market. He's for more transit, bike lanes, affordable housing, increased housing density, and reducing homelessness. But again, he does not lay out any specific policies. He hates the employee hours tax, which he calls the head tax. Other than that, he has a very flashy website with lots and lots of photos and very little text. And it does not say very much about him or his policies and priorities. He has raised $25,272 with 72% of that in democracy vouchers. So he's been out there hustling and shaking hands to get those. And $1,100 of his own money. About 50% of his contributions are from District 6, again, well within that 50% range. And 9% are from outside Seattle. So those are the six candidates with the most contributions. There's a couple of others that have also raised not a lot of money, but enough money for them to campaign. That includes the former NEDI mayoral candidate, Kate Martin, and lawyer and land use planner, Melissa Hall. Some others who have raised enough funds to build a website and do a bit of campaigning are Army National Guard veteran Joey Massa, the conservative John Peoples, who is very conservative, and the indistinguishable Jeremy Cook, who I just could not find a whole lot of information on him. Two other candidates have raised no money and appear to not be actively campaigning, and they don't have websites yet. Former Wallingford Chamber of Commerce President Kara Cirillo and Seattle City employee Ed Potterst, who's run for office before for King County Council about 14 years ago against Larry Phillips. And I don't have a whole lot of other information about him either. So that's District 6 wrapped up for you there. If I were supporting a candidate, it would probably be John Lisbon. A lot of folks are supporting, within the district, are supporting Sergio Garcia. And then of course there's the business candidates, Heidi Wills and Jay Fathy.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anything else on the candidates? There was I know King County.
Yeah, there were some other. There have been some other endorsements out this week. The King County Labor Council released their endorsements in District 1. They're supporting Lisa Herbold, the incumbent there. In District 3, a surprise upset in the last election, they had supported Shama Sawant. This time around, they switched their vote and are supporting Zachary DeWolf, which just goes to show you Zachary DeWolf is one of those hustlers, one of those really super ambitious candidates who's getting out there, filling out all the questionnaires, meeting everybody, shaking hands and everything. But when it comes to actually doing the real work that a politician needs to do when they sit in office, I'm not persuaded he's up to the task. He's not been very active on the school board and, in fact, has been absent in a lot of the school board meetings. And he's only been seated in that seat on the school board for a little over a year. So, and the fact that he's already jumping ship there, I think, is not a good sign. Now, the King County Labor Council also endorsed in District 4 Emily Myers. I guess either Sean Scott didn't apply, or more likely they just weren't comfortable with a socialist and they decided to go with the very pro-labor Emily Myers. Not too much of a surprise there. In District 5, they supported Deborah Juarez. And the reason I think they supported Deborah Juarez is because she's been hustling for those big projects like the renovation of Key Arena, which relies on a lot of union jobs in order to get it done. So there you have the influence of the building trades union pushing the King County Labor Council to support a candidate who's rather conservative because, of course, it's just about the jobs there, folks. Mm-hmm. And then in District 7, they supported Andrew Lewis. And I'll talk a little more about the District 7 candidates. Lewis, I think, may be the most progressive person in District 7 race. So that's the King County Labor Council. There were also, you know, the King County Young Democrats did their endorsements this week. And you can look those up online if you want, as well as the Sierra Club did their endorsements, too. Again, you could look those up online. It's interesting, the Sierra Club, which we usually think of as a more conservative environmental, mainstream environmental group, did endorse Shama Sawant in District 3 and Sean Scott in District 4. So it may seem like they're swinging to the left, but then over in District 5, they support Deborah Juarez, and in District 6, Heidi Wills, who, again, she sits on the executive committee of the Sierra Club's Washington branch. So they'd look kind of stupid if they didn't support her. Mm-hmm. And then in District 7, Michael George, who has a ton of real estate developer money behind him. So, you know, again, Sierra Club looking like they're swinging to the left, but in fact really are not in some of their key endorsements.
All right. So time to move on to national.
Yep, national.
Okay.
The Trump EPA finalized new rules this week for coal-fired power plants. The EPA released the final version of a new rule to replace the Obama-era rule to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. The new rule, the Trump rule, mainly gives states the power to decide how much to regulate power plant emissions or not at all if they choose, and mostly removes that authority from the EPA and the federal government, a very dangerous move for future presidents who might want to regulate greenhouse gas emissions on a national scale. The attorney generals of several states, including California, Oregon, Washington, Iowa, Colorado, and New York, all said that they were preparing plans to sue in order to keep the law from going into effect in 30 days, which is when it would ordinarily go into effect. The Trump administration law would allow the EPA to only go after single power plants that break environmental laws that are already on the books, like dumping toxic waste, for example. Instead, the EPA can only nicely ask state governments to reduce their emissions and allow those state governments to decide what limits they want to impose. The EPA can't set emissions targets, but the states can voluntarily do so. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler said, quote, "It's Congress's role to draft statutes, not the regulatory agencies," end quote, by which he, you know, and I look at that quote and I just go, no, that's wrong. Congress shouldn't be micromanaging regulations based on science. That's what these regulatory agencies like the EPA are tasked to do. It's their job and they should be doing that.
Supposedly, they have scientists working for them.
Yeah, in this case, a political appointee, Andrew Wheeler, is ignoring the science in order to promulgate a rule that guts his own agency and will be responsible for unnecessary deaths. Harvard University and Syracuse University have both released a study last year that shows that pollutants like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide will increase in at least 19 states under this new rule. And even the Trump administration's own analysis by their internal scientists what you would call, you know, scientists pressured by the political appointees above them, and what you would call the rosy picture shows hundreds of additional deaths and hospitalizations because of the new rule. That's the rosy picture. The not so rosy picture estimates that the deaths would increase by over 5,000 by the year 2030. And that's just deaths from the direct health effects of inhaling toxic pollutants from coal-fired power plants. The deaths related to climate change could eventually reach the millions or billions if we do nothing to slow or stop our greenhouse gas emissions.
All right. So there are states, though, that are challenging that. Mm-hmm. There has been some success.
Yes.
Pushing back from the state level.
Yes, there has. And there have been some states who have imposed their own internal greenhouse gas limits and their own targets, including here in the state of Washington. And that's very promising. But again, really dealing with our global carbon emissions is not something that should be done on the state level. It's something that should be done as high up as possible on the national level and as part of a global coordinated effort.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
Moving on. speaking of coordinated efforts, tomorrow might be a big day for some coordinated efforts.
The ICE has announced immigration raids on immigrant families projected to start tomorrow on Sunday. Now, it's known in the Trump administration as the quote unquote family op. And we're not referring to those selfies that Ivanka, Eric, and Don Jr. took during their recent trip to Europe. No, Donald Trump is specifically targeting 2,000 immigrant families with children for arrest and deportation. Because, you know, I guess those families with children are just so evil, right? Now, the pre-dawn raids are expected to start this weekend on Sunday in 10 major cities. And those cities are Chicago, New Orleans, Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, Miami, Houston, Denver, Atlanta, and Baltimore. Seattle, as far as I know, is not on that list. So if people around town are in a panic, in hiding, not going to their doctor's appointments, not taking their kids to school, I don't think we need to worry. On the other hand, if you see anything like an ICE raid, and they don't always wear uniforms, they often go in plain clothes, it's okay to film. It's okay to record.
That is still legal in
yes,
the U.S.
As long as you are on public property or you are invited onto private property and are welcomed there by the residents, you can film.
And you are not getting in the way of operations.
Yeah. And I would suggest you send that film to the ACLU once you have take photos if you're not able to
And good to make to film. Backup copies.
Yeah. Now, there's two reasons why they're doing these raids starting at dawn, like a military raid on an Iraqi village. It's because, one, the element of surprise means they'll be less, that the residents of a home will be less able to flee, and few people can put up much resistance when they're awakened out of a sound sleep by somebody kicking in their door and pointing a gun in their face. And two, ICE wants to make sure that they scoop up the families when everybody's together so that they don't make that old mistake of separating the kids from their parents, because, of course, that's a really bad family photo op right there for the Trump administration. So this operation has been a long time in the works, but there's been some resistance within even the conservative Trump administration to actually implementing it. Apparently, former Department of Homeland Security Chief Christian Nielsen and former acting ICE director Ronald Vitello were both fired for resisting the family op. Current acting Department of Homeland Security head Kevin McAleenan has also been resisting it, which is why Trump went around him to coordinate directly with the new acting ICE director Mark Morgan. Morgan, I want to point out, served for 3.5 months as chief of Border Patrol before Trump was elected, and he lost his job as soon as the new administration came in. Before that, Morgan was an FBI agent and worked in internal affairs inside the Border Patrol, so his knowledge of immigration law is severely lacking. In fact, he's actually the perfect lackey for Donald Trump, someone who's deeply unqualified for his job and who owes his job entirely to Donald Trump's, whether Donald Trump likes him or not. And he definitely knows that he owes his job to him for that reason. So this horrible family op is going to be starting tomorrow at dawn.
Supposedly going to be starting.
Supposedly.
Tomorrow. I mean, there's no reason that they wouldn't start things early, you know, make a public announcement and then start things early.
Yeah, or later.
Or expand, or expand the number of cities.
Yeah, and it's expected to go multiple days. So if, again, if you see any such activity like that in Seattle or in neighboring cities or in any or the city where you live, it is perfectly okay to record. You'll want to announce that you are just there to record. And let them know that you're not going to do anything else but watch. And if they try to take your camera from you, just tell them that they don't have that right, because you have every right to be there and to record as long as you are still on public land or as long as you have been invited on to the site by the people who live there.
And there's good local organizations that...
There are a lot of good local organizations around town and in various cities that are dealing with the immigration crisis. And they would appreciate a call if you see any activity like that, too. Because a lot of them have hotlines or have ways to get the word out to immigrant communities that this is happening. So
in addition to, like, the ACLU, which is an obvious choice... there's also La Resistance, which is the
La Resistance, yeah.
Was formerly named the Northwest
Detention Center.
Resistance. There is also the Northwest Immigration Rights Project. Mm-hmm. And
I believe, isn't there a Washington Immigration Rights?
There's also a Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network.
Yeah.
So
their website, I think, is down, but there's. I think you can email them still, and I think it's a WAIN or ISN .org, I think, is there.
But social media is a good way to...
you can find them on Facebook, I'm sure.
Keep up on things. And the flip side of it is to only pass along information when you have verified things.
Yeah.
It's really important not to...
And, you know, Seattle is a sanctuary city. So if you're seeing Seattle police doing something, it's probably not assisting an immigration raid. That would be my guess at this point.
I would recommend to document things regardless.
Yeah, it may have to do with something else. It probably is not an immigration raid. But if it is, if you see ICE with Seattle police, that would be useful information, too.
Yeah. There have been other... other entities in the state, for instance, the Department
who
of Licensing,
assisted
that
ICE, yes.
Exactly. So again, it's something that bears witnessing and documenting, regardless of how sure you are the given situation.
It is perfectly okay too to ask those folks if they have a warrant and who is the warrant for, as well as to ask them to identify themselves.
All right. So one last thing, if we can squeeze it in right before events, briefly, let's just touch on how we came pretty close to a war here the other day.
We almost entered a war with Iran. Yeah. On Thursday morning, Iran had shot down a U.S. surveillance drone that it said had violated its airspace. Of course, the Trump administration said the drone was in international airspace in the Strait of Hormuz off the coast of Iran. You know, of course, even if the drone was in international airspace, a U.S. surveillance drone flying a few miles from the coast of Iran in a strategic waterway is definitely a provocation, regardless of what you read in the New York Times or see on Fox News or CNN. That is a provocation. Now, so the question was really, how would Donald Trump respond to this? And the answer apparently is impulsively. He launched an attack, then canceled it at the last minute. So the ships were in position, the planes were in the air, the missiles ready to go, and then Trump changed his mind. Now, part of the problem is that he surrounded himself with a team of rabid militarists who hate Iran, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and CIA Director Gina Haspel all wanted the attack to go forward. But apparently, after expanding his list of advisors to include experts at the Pentagon and as well as TV personalities at Fox News, he decided that, no, it would probably put U.S. troops in the region and U.S. interests at risks and alienate his base of support if he attacked Iran. Now, I've talked about U.S. interests and what that means before. In terms of foreign policy is those Western oil companies that want to extract oil resources from Persian Gulf nations. Sure, they'd like to get their hands on Iranian oil, but not at the expense of their sweet deals with Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And a war in the Persian Gulf could definitely cut off the ability to ship oil from those nations to global markets. Now, Trump withdrew from the nuclear agreement. I just want to point out, too, that this crisis was a crisis that Trump created himself. He withdrew from the nuclear agreement with Iran and slapped sanctions on that country as a way to ratchet up pressure on Iran's government. He claimed that it was his way of preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. But when the sanctions were tightened last month, Iran announced that it was going to violate a key part of the nuclear agreement for the first time. And that was beginning to enrich uranium again and to stockpile more than the agreement allows. So Trump's moves have only increased the likelihood that Iran will develop a weapon and sped up the timetable, not slowed it down. So Trump is really playing a dangerous game that he clearly doesn't fully understand. And yes, that is very scary. And it's another reason why the House Democrats should be initiating impeachment proceedings as soon as possible.
All right, events.
Yeah, this weekend is the Fremont Fair and Solstice Celebration. Head on over to Fremont and you can't miss it. Tomorrow, June 23rd, is the free nonviolent direct action training for anyone who wants to learn how to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. That's hosted by Extinction Rebellion Seattle at University Temple United Methodist Church from 12:30 to 6:30 p.m. That's at 1415 Northeast 43rd, right here in the U District. Enter the church in the alley between 15th Avenue Northeast and the Ave. Also tomorrow, Tom Hartman will be at Town Hall to talk about his book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. That's at 7 p.m. at Town Hall at 1119 8th Avenue at Seneca Street. Monday, June 24th, you can go ask the City Council to support a Green New Deal. Council Member Mike O'Brien is expected to ask the council to endorse the campaign for a Green New Deal. Got Green, 350 Seattle, and other organizations will be there at City Council chambers to push for a yes vote. That's at 2 p.m. at 600 4th Avenue at James Street downtown. On Wednesday, June 26th, and Thursday, June 27th, is the first presidential debate for Democratic candidates held over two evenings. You can join any of the debate watching parties around town, or, and this is my suggestion, hold one of your own and invite family and friends to watch the two-night debate and discuss which candidates you support and why.
Come over and yell at your place.
Yeah. June is Pride Month, and the last weekend of the month is typically a lot of events to celebrate. On Friday, June 28th, is the Trans Pride Seattle 2019 in the heart of Capitol Hill in the Broadway District. That starts at 5 p.m. on Friday, right after work gets out. You start your weekend there. On Saturday, June 29th, is the official Pride Fest Capitol Hill. That starts at noon and runs until 9 p.m. with the Seattle Dyke March at 5 to 8 p.m. On the same day in Cal Anderson Park is the Family Day / Queer Youth Pride Stage from 1 to 7 p.m., including the Doggy Drag Show from 3 to 4 p.m., which allows our allies of a different species to get involved in the festivities. On Sunday, June 30th, is the larger and more corporate Pride Fest Seattle Center, which starts at 11 a.m. with the march through downtown to Seattle Center and goes all day. So that's your Pride Fest weekend of activities.
All right. So we will see you next week.
Yes, then. Next week I will be here, and maybe Jav.
Yeah, fingers crossed that we might get Jav back next week.
Yeah, and I'll be wrapping up my look at the City Council endorsement.
District 7. District, we will finally find out. The secrets of District 7.
Who's running in the downtown core?
All right.